Well, as Dr. Sukula mentioned, my name is Jason Omhin, and I am in fact going to be presenting on optical frequency contacting. I am a sophomore, about to be a junior, and a computer science major. To begin, I'll give you a brief outline of what we'll be talking about. I'll start with a small scenario, which will begin to motivate exactly why we use this technique in the first place, as well as give you a high-level overview of how it works and some applications. And then we'll dig deeper into the fundamental basics, the mathematical bases for the technique and physical bases. By going on a little bit about complex waveforms and the Fourier transform itself. So suppose you're some research scientist and you really, really want to study atomic structures, say an atom, on the order of really small time intervals like femtoseconds, 10 to the minus 15. This is really hard to do with previous well-known techniques like interferometry. It's really hard to do because the kind of precision that you're getting is 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 7. And then suppose further that you wish to study something well-known like the hydrogen atom. We know a lot about its properties. And you wish to use what you're going to observe to find out whether or not your crazy hypothesis that perhaps the speed of light isn't so constant, or gravity, or something else, some other phenomenon. And to do this, you set up some crazy lab where you literally shoot one photon, I mean, not one photon, but you shoot at one atom, a laser that you have set up. You have it set up in such a way that you're shooting monochromatic light, and you will excite that atom to some excited state, and then you will then observe the radiation that you get back when it raises back down to the ground state. This is basically what laser-based spectroscopy is, and also the basis for the optical frequency cone technique. As I said, you'll be using a laser. In particular, it's called a mode-locked laser, which enables really, 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 really rapid pulses of light to be transmitted. You'll be doing it with one frequency of light, and the idea is that the waveforms that you'll be shooting are actually, since they're so short apart, that they'll actually be slightly compressed, and thus what you'll observe later is that upon analysis you'll actually be generating a frequency, an entire spectrum of frequencies, instead of just one frequency like you might predict. And actually, the composite frequencies will also be uniformly spaced, as well as very short together. Ideally, they would be a continuum, but as we know, you can't actually have infinity. And the bottom picture is sort of kind of a schematic of the entire setup. So, going with a ruler-like analogy, as you will then take the radiation that you perceive from, say, a hydrogen atom dropping from the 2s to 1s state, which is actually in the ultraviolet spectrum, and you sort of will take this cone that you have now generated and sort of mix and match like you would with a ruler, like if you're measuring some length, you know. And since the composing frequencies are actually really close together, this allows for an extremely high degree of accuracy. And we can also sort of alter our ruler by either generating wider pulses or shorter pulses in such a way that a shorter pulse will actually increase the amount of wavelengths that are going to be inherent in our spectrum. And the bottom picture sort of further illustrates what that cone looks like in another graphical representation, not just position, but this is actually frequency. So a few applications that this can be used for is to sort of measure spaces. This is in the space. It's actually used in the global positioning satellite systems to measure times to an extreme precision, about 15 decimal places. And one recent, well, fairly recent application when this technique was discovered was to sort of redefine 1 meter to be the amount of distance traveled by the speed of light in 1/300 millionth of a second. Not quite the speed of light, as you see, but very, very close. Now, these are the two gentlemen here that are responsible for the optical frequency cone technique, and they had also won a Nobel Prize for it back in 2005, so quite recent indeed. Now, going a little bit further, as we know in classes, and you know, and during our studies, we study quite nice functions. The waveforms that we're used to, even the ones that you might think are really complex, that are just like a few terms of a Fourier series, are very, very simple. Compared to those, you know, waves that you would find in nature, like my voice, music, or even the snap of your fingers, it's pretty much a very complex wave. But you might wonder why we even bother to study these. Well, it turns out that you can use complex waves, one particular called a pulse, or a packet, synonymous, to study a well-localized particle in quantum mechanics. It's actually a really good model for a very, very small particle on a very small scale. The problem here is that they're not periodic functions. So how do you build a periodic non-periodic function with, you know, you can't just take it out of the ether? Well, you can actually build a non-periodic function with a series of periodic functions, and in more specifically, cosines and sines. The only difference you have to make is that if you think about you know, sums of sines and cosines, the kind of, even that curve right there, you can imagine it to be a sum of sine and cosine, even though it's just a simple sine curve, you could still view it to be a sum. But the thing is that you want to make sure that you're not repeating fundamental wavelengths, that you want to make them different each time. And you can have integer multiples of them, you just want to make sure that the discrete wavelengths outweigh the kind of integer multiples that you might have. So this beckons the Fourier transform, which gives rise to the ability to study waveforms themselves. Simply said, that we'll go a little deeper in a second, but what you get when you perform a Fourier transform on a wave function or a waveform, you will actually get what is called the wave spectral content, which is simply the amount of wave number or wavelength that is put into that resulting wave. From here on out, I'll be talking about wave number because instead of wavelength, it's a little bit more convenient, but remember that it's inversely proportional. Now, when I was talking about the motivating example, I talked about the beams of monochromatic light from the laser. That's one frequency that you might think about, but to actually make a pulse, which is actually really, you'll see one of this a little bit later, they're actually quite complex waveforms. So it's a non-periodic function. You have to build it with a bunch of other wavelengths, or wave numbers, rather. But you want one to win out all of the others so that you can get that visible difference. Well, the idea here is to sort of symmetrically add more wave numbers about your dominant wave number, k sub 0 I have here, to such a way that you have a little bit less amplitude of the other wave numbers, but they're equally spaced apart. And as you keep adding them, you'll get a more precise picture of what you want. And in doing this, you'll actually be ending up defining a function of wave number we call here a sub k, which again, describes the wave, the spectral content of your wave. This is an illustration of what I've been just talking about. The very top is a simple cosine curve which has one dominant wave number. And as you see, even just adding two wave numbers that are symmetric about the corresponding, their dominant wave number, you start to see that diamond-shaped pattern, but there's a bunch of, they're repeating, you don't want that. If you want one pulse one time, you have to eliminate the repeating factors. So if you keep adding wave numbers in a symmetric way, you see that you start to diminish the repeating offenders, and then eventually, at the bottom, the idealistic term would be to have a complete continuum, an infinite amount of wave numbers between, in a small distance between around your case of zero. So, consider that we will be using, one of the most fundamental functions that we talk about, even in this class, is the plane wave, and the solution for a plane wave to the Schrodinger equation. You can use that to do so many things, and in particular, we'll actually be using it as a sort of building block from which we can build a bunch of other wave forms and the like. So, we will actually be, even if with this pulse at the very, very bottom, we will be using a function, like I said before, a sub k, to sort of use those, the amplitudes of each corresponding wave number as a constant, as a scaling factor to the wave function. Now, the plane wave solution is e sub I k x, which doesn't sound very periodic, and it doesn't sound like a bunch of sines and cosines. But if you recall the Euler formula, it's actually cosine kx plus I sine kx, which is indeed a linear combination of trigonometric functions. So if we have our sort of our infinite amount of wave numbers for which we want to build our packet, then we can imagine multiplying the amplitude that you want for that and the corresponding solution to the wave number to the wave function and add them up in an infinite fashion, which you get an integral. And this will build, you will then get a function of position for describing your wave pulse. And in particular, if you then, you can see in actually in Appendix D of your book, if you then solve that this function for A of K, which sounds circular, but I will explain in a moment, you will get what's called the Fourier transform applied to psi of x, which essentially does give back what we started with, which was a function describing the spectral content. But because we have derived the Fourier transform, you can imagine taking a wave function and of some random waveform. And then you can apply the Fourier transform, and you can see exactly its constituent elements and how much of each are being applied. This is quite fascinating. And in particular, you can use this relationship to sort of go back and forwards and forward. It is actually indeed an inverse relationship. And if you think about the way that the more narrow the wave packet, the broader the frequency that you'll be generating. If you then think about actually constructing a function that can model an entire range of frequencies, then you know that will result in a narrower wave packet. So if you do that and you perform an inverse transformation, you'll actually then get the corresponding wave function for it. And then you will then be able to go from there and build whatever devices that you want, such as a laser, to take advantage of that. And that is also a picture of what the result from an inverse Fourier transformation, which is just a function of, this is actually a function of time, because if you So if you perform a Fourier transform on a wave function as a function of x, so you keep time constant, you say, for simplistic sake, you have your function as a snapshot at time equals zero, then you will actually be getting what we said before, the function of k, a wave number, which is also proportional to wavelength. But if you give it but if you keep a position constant and you go with time, you vary time, then you'll actually go into the frequency domain and you'll get the frequencies instead. So that's all that is that they went from a frequency domain back to the time domain. And this is sort of the sum total of everything I've been talking about, in that the optical frequency cone technique itself, you're shooting laser, you can then analyze, you know exactly what you're shooting off, you can then use your known graph in the spectrum space, and then analyze your result that you got in order to, you know, sort of mismatch and, you know, check to see what you got. The graph on the left is also a more vivid description of what the Fourier transform actually does. And that is actually all. I will open it up to any questions that you may have, and a list of my resources that I use.
Okay.
As such.
All right, let's thank Jason. Okay, so questions?
I have one.
Yes.
I guess my question is, what's kind of limiting our advance in this? Are we limited by, like, the computational power to compute these Fourier transforms when we get them back? Or are we limited by, I guess, the range of frequencies that we can shoot at? Do you know which of these are both limiting our ability to get more precise?
Right.
I know that I've done some of the MATLAB stuff with Fourier transforms, and I know it takes a lot of computational power to go through a Fourier transform. And the more
terms that you have, MATLAB in particular will perform what's called a discrete Fourier transform in order to approximate what the perfect transform would be.
Right.
So the more terms you have, you'll get a more accurate result. But to answer your question, it definitely is a
limiting factor.
The more you just want as many chances as you can get, essentially.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if the range of frequencies that we can spit out of the laser, if that was limiting, or if our ability to
at least the way I'm thinking about it, if you go a little bit too broad with your spectrum, then you might end up diminishing your capacity to sort of determine where you're at, I guess.
Okay.
Like when you want to match them up. Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. So you go into the frequency domain to speed up computation from the time domain, correct? Is that not?
No. That's what you're getting from the function itself when you're applying it. So if you have, to recall, when we did Schrodinger wave equations and wave functions, that the full function was actually a function of position and time. And in our case, we only did one dimensional position, but for simplicity. But if you focus on the time portion of that function and you perform the transform on that, then you'll actually get a range of frequencies that correspond to that wave.
Yeah, so we're taking it from the time.
Yes.
The frequency?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you go back to that
sure.
picture with the actual wave going back? It's near the actual device that you're talking about.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. Yeah, I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit more about that. Because I see, so you have the laser coming out in nanosecond or femtosecond pulses. Is it going into the frequency domain because it can process these femtosecond pulses quicker? Or I'm just wondering. I'm trying to draw the connection between what is because we can process it faster and what is because of the pulses and such?
Like, well, because you can process it faster, you're actually essentially, because you can process it so fast, then the resulting waves will be sort of compacted a little bit, and they'll end up being more of wave packets than actual wave, like, repeating. They're gonna be less periodic, essentially. So what you're gonna get is, instead of one wave number, you're gonna get an entire, you know, spectrum of them. I mean,
so with these pulses, what are we
I don't know exactly. I don't know exactly how they got to go so fast, to be honest. But I know that because they are going that fast, that you can generate wave pulses to begin with.
Yeah. That's sort of, I guess my last question is, what are we trying to find with these pulses? You said, yeah, I kind of lost it. So with the pulses, we're trying to detect wave.
Okay. So with the pulses, you know, within the known pulses that you have, you can sort of, you can perform a transform on the wave function for that, and you'll get the comb as a measuring device. So you're shooting these pulses at some atomic structure in a really rapid fashion, and you're going to be getting electromagnetic radiation back from the atom, hopefully, depending on what kind of energies you're using. And then you'll be using what you're observed to sort of compare.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. So I got it now.
And what you'll be observing is more periodic, so you won't have to worry.
Yeah.
All right.
So if you're sending in pulses and you're getting a range of these frequencies.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you, since like each of the pulses have harmonics inside them, why wouldn't you just send like certain frequencies and test the result of different frequencies individually and still make the buff? So I mean, like, for like a radar, if it's bad to have those harmonics, you want as fine tuned to like one certain frequency as you can. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we using something with more harmonics than that? Is it just easier to compute, like, to see the range of the spectrum as a whole, or?
I don't think I actually know the answer to that question. I do know that the more harmonics that you have, essentially, you're going to end up with a periodic function. You want to outbalance. You want to sort of overweigh the harmonics that you have. I mean, I don't know why you would have some harmonics as opposed to no harmonics, to be honest. But it's sort of what I took away.
Any more questions?
Actually,
one last question.
Yeah. Can you just repeat what you said about the light stuff? You said that they were able to.
Go ahead.
I didn't get that exactly.
With.
When you measured the meter to be one over.
So. That.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Okay.
So they were able to determine, essentially, by. I think the way that they set it up was that it would only I think they would have it at least as close to 1 meter as I thought it would be, and transmit that light over that distance, and they probably sort of changed it if it you know, resulted in different numbers, but I would assume that the calculations, because you can easily, you know, sort of determine how far a light would go, you know, because you know its speed and you know its distance, you know how long it's supposed to take. I mean, you can calculate it, but you can get the frequency, if you shoot it at something what you think is 1 meter away, and you know, you get that frequency back, then you can, you know, sort of correspond that back to time, and then see how long that took.
Okay, let's thank Jason one more time.